Welcome to the Poundcast, the Digital Pound Foundation's podcast, dedicated to explaining and discussing all aspects of a digital pound and the impact of new forms of digital money. Your host today is Jan Apache, policy lead and one of the originating members of the Digital Pound Foundation. Today, Jana is in conversation with Varun Paul, Central Bank Digital Currency and Market Infrastructure Director of Fireblocks. Jana and Varun discuss private sector objections to retail central bank digital currency. How does the recent Bank of England and HM Treasury consultation address these as regards the UK? They also look at non-interest bearing and its limits. How will this address concerns of outflows from commercial bank deposits? And they ask, how will a digital pound support private sector innovation and how might such a currency be designed?
So Varun, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very excited, especially given your work both currently and previously in this area of CBDCs. And so this is going to be a very topical and interesting conversation. Could you please introduce yourself and what you're doing at Fireblocks?
Thanks for having me on, Jana. My name is Varun Paul. I am currently Director for Central Bank Digital Currency and Financial Market Infrastructure at Fireblocks, which is a digital asset infrastructure provider. But I've spent most of my career so far actually at the Bank of England. I was at the Bank of England until only last year, most recently as head of FinTech Hub, where I worked on things like the future of finance and the future of money, and came across to Fireblocks towards the start of last year.
So we're recording this on the 15th of February. At the time of recording, the Bank of England's recent consultation on the digital pound is very fresh in everyone's minds and the headlines as well, given that it was only published last week. So tell us a little bit about that consultation and where in the bank's timeline of CBDC-related activities it sits and what its purpose is.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting couple of weeks. First, we had the consultation paper on crypto asset regulation, and then the consultation on the digital pound. It's kept a lot of us busy. I think putting those two together, it's important to say that I think the UK is setting out its vision for a crypto hub, a digital asset hub, and the fact that you get the two alongside each other is really important, because what the authorities are saying is we're going to have a really clear regime for digital assets. And in support of that, we're going to have a very clear vision for a digital pound. And what's also clear is this is a process that's going to take a number of years. And they talked about the digital pound not being released, launched until at least the second half of the decade. So we're looking, everyone's focusing on 2025 to 2030 and imagining when it might come out. But the key thing, I think, to take away is, at a high level, is that it is designed to be a platform for private sector innovation. And I say that because it's very clear in there that it's not designed to replace other forms of digital assets, other forms of money like stablecoins. It's designed to sit there alongside them and alongside things like cash. So that's a clear mark in the sand there. And I think it pulls together the whole ecosystem of digital assets in the UK.
You mentioned marks in the sand there, and this consultation paper actually sets out some very clear marks in the sand with respect to some key design decisions and policy decisions around a public digital pound, doesn't it? Could you outline a few of those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that may have surprised people a little bit, especially if you look around the world, is that it's very clear that it's a retail CBDC that they're offering. And whereas previously people would have said, we can imagine a wholesale central bank digital currency, which forms a backing asset, and then you'd have privately issued stablecoins issuing into the market, and they would be the ones interacting with retail customers. This has got a clear vision for a retail central bank digital currency, and I'm sure we'll come into more of this detail as we go. But the main drawback or the main criticism of a direct retail CBDC was that you risk disintermediating the whole banking system, because you give them a riskless asset. You give retail customers a riskless asset. And there's always a risk then that a consumer will want to take their money out of a bank account and put it into this new form of money and store all their money in that. Now, to counter that, what they've gone and done is said, well, we might have, well, A, we're not going to pay any interest on it. So it's a non-interest bearing, which obviously gives a bank account a slight leg up relative to the new digital pound. It means that as a customer, you'd rather store your money in a bank account because you'll get rewarded for that. The other thing they've said is that they will put limits on the amount you can hold, and at least in the transition, in order that you'd avoid this mass exodus into something that's perceived as less risky and safer to hold the digital pound because it's got the backing of the central bank. So those two things in conjunction help to mitigate this idea that you'd create a financial stability risk by introducing a retail CBDC.
And that's really interesting because it also points to the main use case of the CBDC, or the main overarching use case, because there are many, many in sub-use cases and applications across many sectors. But the main intention of the CBDC, if you will, is that it be used for day-to-day transactions more than anything else. So it's very much a transactional thing rather than something that people hold as a long-term store of value. So you're not going to put your life savings into it. You're instead going to be transacting day to day, right?
That's exactly right. They see this as part of an everyday transaction payment method, and it should sit alongside many different types of payments, whether that be cash, cards, bank-to-bank payments, and even in the future, stable coins. So what's clear is they see this as part of a diverse ecosystem of payment methods. Now, the interesting thing is that in the future, what they're worried about in this world where you've got different types of payments is that you could have some stablecoin payment methods that kind of create walled gardens and make it difficult for you to interchange between one from one to the other and then back to cash, for example. In that kind of future ecosystem with digital assets coexisting alongside cash, they want to ensure that £10 is worth £10 as it is today, no matter where it is. And so they want to provide this uniformity of money, they call it. And that's the clear actual purpose of providing the digital pound in the future.
So sort of like interoperability rails between different new forms of digital money and existing payment rails potentially as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Glue that holds it together.
Yeah. And the reason this is really important is that in today's money, increasingly, we're starting to move away from banknotes, which is a public sector provision of money. It's a public liability of the central bank. We're moving more and more to private forms of money, as I described, cards and bank payments. And as we move into the stablecoin realm, you can see how the incentives are aligned for a stablecoin issuer to want you to continue to exist in their ecosystem, to spend their money and re-spend it and potentially get paid in that currency, even if it is tied to the fiat currency. And so they've got a real important desire to make sure that you don't get locked in and that you have the interoperability, exactly as you say, in the future.
And this is getting into something that I personally found super interesting about this discussion paper, that money is a public utility and that it has a really fundamental role to play in ensuring trust and stability in the financial ecosystem. And we've seen many objections to the concept of retail CBDCs from banks and other private sector actors around the world, and particularly in the US with the American Bankers Association and certain private companies as well. And again, this isn't limited to the bank space. Some stablecoin issuers as well, who are all saying, we see the argument for a wholesale CBDC because this can improve the behind-the-scenes settlement infrastructure and things like that. But when it comes to retail CBDC, you don't really need to worry about the central banks. We've got it covered. We can provide all of these services. And tying it back to the UK in particular, as you know, we've had these recent debates in Parliament and the House of Lords and the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee with its report on CBDCs, a solution looking for a problem and things like that. And there's a lot of soul searching going on as to why we need a CBDC in the UK. Like, after all, we've got this quite sophisticated payments infrastructure. We've got that covered. Financial inclusion, unlike other jurisdictions, is not our primary reason for needing to introduce one, nor is distribution of cash or anything like that. So why specifically do we need a CBDC? And reading the paper, it really addressed some of those questions quite neatly in providing a specific rationale for why we do need a retail CBDC. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I thought that bit of the paper was really neat. It confronted it head on and explained the motivation from the central bank. If I take it back two steps, the central bank, certainly the Bank of England's, considered its remit is both the monetary stability and financial stability. And the monetary stability is obviously driven in large part by setting interest rates to control inflation, control the spending power of the money in your pocket. But as part of that, it's also about protecting the value of the currency. And protecting the value of the currency means protecting the integrity of the banknotes that you spend. Now, in a digital world, that motivation changes. So today, it is the Bank of England's responsibility to provide a trusted form of money that people can spend. And they do that through banknotes. In the future, where we have everything or migrating more and more towards digital payments, digital services, and we're interacting online more in metaverses potentially, and interacting with other digital assets, they see a clear role for providing that same for that same requirement, providing a form of public money that can interact with these digital assets. And clearly a banknote isn't going to work when you're interacting with NFTs on a Web3 platform in the future. So they see this role as continuing in the future, and therefore they need to provide something that is a public form of digital money, a liability of the central bank that works for the financial system and the economy of the future. And I really like the way they confronted that head on. They made it very clear that this is not a solution for today. This is a solution for tomorrow, and it's going to take time to build. So we need to start working on it and deciding how we would design it and whether it's and exactly how we want it to work. And so compared to the arguments exactly as you described, which in many ways sound very old fashioned, to say the House of Lords committee saying, why are we working on these on this digital nonsense? I think actually the Bank of England stance is very forward looking. It's been very reasonable and measured. And what it is saying is that we are going to need to be somewhere different in 5 years' time. And if cash usage has declined to such a point that actually people are heavily reliant on private sector money, then we will not have done our job. So it's really important for the Bank of England to provide this digital form of public money that people can trust. And thereby, as I said before, ensuring that a £10 is worth it, a tenner, always and everywhere. And I think that's a really important motivation.
And you've mentioned private sector innovation as well. So on one hand, we've got lots of private sector actors, particularly the commercial banks, being concerned about what the impact of this is on their deposits and on credit creation in the future, and very much focused on, well, what does it mean? This mean for the existing financial system? And the banks also made clear that its job is not to ensure the continuity of existing commercial bank business models. Its job is to ensure continued financial stability in whatever form that takes, which is it's an interesting point that they continually reiterate. But they have addressed those specific concerns, as we mentioned, through the design of the CBDC being non-interest bearing and having holding limits and things like that. But let's talk a little bit more about this concept of private sector innovation. How can the introduction of a retail CBDC stimulate private sector innovation? And how does the design of that kind of tainted market infrastructure around it, how is it conducive to private sector innovation?
Really good question. I think the bit I really like is that it focuses on what the central bank can only do, and it therefore focuses on the infrastructure at the heart of the system. But what it says quite clearly is it doesn't want to replace the private sector innovation. It wants to leave room for private sector to provide stable coins, for example, that will complement or work alongside this CBDC. The other part of it, going back to the start of your question, was that one of the risks that was put out there for a retail CBDC is that not only do you disintermediate the banking system, take away or raise their cost of funds, but you also end up in a situation where the central bank, as a result of that, would end up being responsible for credit creation, credit allocation. And we've seen through history that governments and central banks are not as efficient or effective at allocating credit. And the third bit is that you don't want to be in a situation where the central bank is responsible for KYC and AML on every transaction in the economy, because that would just break their infrastructure. And so what this does is it does have this intermediary layer, and it protects the role for the intermediary in onboarding a customer and dealing with the customer, dealing with customer complaints and so on, something that the central bank is never going to be good at. And as a result of that, I think it does provide a platform. It provides a platform for private sector to innovate on, and that should be the clear goal. And what I mean by that is it's putting out a vision there. It's setting out a clear standard and saying, this is what the central bank digital currency will look like. This is the role that we are going to fulfill. It's going to be non-interest bearing. It's going to protect privacy, and it is going to ensure essentially zero cost transaction between different types of money. We're going to mandate that. So you can build around those goals and those criteria that we're setting. And therefore, the private sector can now think about what it wants to innovate upon and where it can provide additional services. For example, continuing to provide interest in bank accounts, or providing programmable money, because they've also said that the digital pound is going to be a kind of a done currency in that respect. And so they can provide smarter currencies and do programmable payments and automated payments and that kind of thing. So in that respect, by separating out what the central bank is doing, but not providing every bit of the digital money ecosystem in the future. They've set the rules and allowed the private sector to figure out from this where they can offer additional services.
And I think in addition to the private sector skepticism that we've seen around and concerns that we've seen around the introduction of a digital pound, there are also a lot of public concerns globally as well. So from the general public, and we've touched on privacy there, but also there are concerns that if you're holding your life savings in CBDC and you misbehave or something like that, the central bank will be able to, or the government will be able to step in and take your money away. And I think there's also, you know, a growing recognition that a lot of these things can be done in the traditional financial system today. Like, take the example of the Canadian truckers. Their accounts were frozen without the need for a CBDC. But how specifically does this paper go into addressing some of those public concerns? We've touched on privacy, but how does it actually address it? And how can the design of a CBDC provide guarantees to the public that their privacy is protected?
It's a really legitimate concern from people to know and to trust that their government is not going to be using technology to spy on them. And this argument is felt all around the world. But I've often said that it would make no sense in a world in which you've got many options, it would make no sense for a central bank to issue a token that allowed them to spy on you. Because as a retail customer, you'd simply choose to go with a stable coin that protected your privacy instead. And it seems that is borne out by the paper, and they've been quite clear about that. They've basically said it doesn't make sense for us to do anything to jeopardize trust. So we must build trust in this digital pound from the start. And part of that is ensuring that you can trust in the privacy of your spending. And what they've done is said very clearly that they will have no ability to monitor or to view individual transactions by retail customers. Instead, it will be the wallet provider that is responsible, as I said, for onboarding and for monitoring for anti-money laundering purposes and so on, the transactions. And that's very similar to the system we have today, where your card company is monitoring transactions to protect against fraud, and the bank account provider is responsible for ensuring that the actions are legitimate. What they then have is, because they've got this abstraction between the central bank and the retail customers, is only aggregate data will be passed up from the intermediary to the central bank. And in that way, you're protecting the individual customer from being spied upon, but you're also ensuring that the central bank can have an idea of what the aggregate levels of activity are in the economy to understand the financial flows and obviously to run the financial system effectively using this new rail. What I like is that the paper did confront it head on. It also made very clear that it was a core foundational criteria that it could be trusted and therefore wouldn't be used for spying. And so I think it has privacy built in. And I think that's really important and really powerful. And actually, I think it goes a lot further than any other jurisdiction in the world at the moment. And I think it sets the benchmark for future CBDC development from other countries as well.
That's a really interesting observation. And I think if we also take that in the context of what private sector stablecoin issuers might be considering for their business models, if it's kind of one thing if a commercial bank is issuing a commercial bank money token or a deposit token or something like that, but if you've got a social media platform or an online shopping platform that is introducing its own stablecoin, a lot of the value of introducing that is actually in the data, the transactional data that can be collected, right? So is this almost saying that potentially a CBDC could offer more privacy in the UK than privately issued stablecoins might?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And exactly as you say, we've seen that providers of, for example, social media platforms or big e-commerce companies all have an incentive to monetize that data, and they'll do it in different ways. But increasingly, the corporates are thinking about how they can monetize that, the data they have on customers. And as everything becomes more and more digital, that becomes easier for them. And so, yes, of course, the risk is that actually it's the private sector who is going to be using your data on your spending habits, potentially in a positive way to help you, to support you with the right advertising. But obviously, people should be legitimately worried about how they might use the data as well. And I think exactly as you say, with foresight, the Bank of England here is saying there is a world in which that is a problem for consumers, and they end up in a situation where they can't actually spend money in a way that protects their privacy. And this is not anonymity, but privacy. And so they're providing a version that does protect their privacy. And the distinction between anonymity and privacy is key here. It's not designed to be like a banknote in which there is complete anonymity. And if you spend that money, no one can see what's happened to it. This is more like the privacy preserving mechanism involved in bank payments and card payments today. And so, as you've described, the digital pound is designed to offer a private method of payments, exactly contrary to people's concerns. And so at least this offers a privacy ensuring alternative to a future in which private sector providing stable coins or digital forms of money, where they will always have an incentive to monetize that data.
And then finally, I think let's dive into the design a little bit more. At a design level, there's often the concepts of accounts versus token-based models are often discussed. And in token-based models, we're often associating them with distributed ledger technologies, blockchains, and things like that. Is there anything in the paper to indicate whether the bank is considering an account-based or a token-based model, and whether it is considering a DLT platform underlying this?
So it, in some respect, it's buried away a little bit in here. There's many pages in the consultation paper, and for the large part of the main paper, it talks about a digital pound, but doesn't get into the details of what that will look like. And so much of this is left of the technical paper. Now, they talk about having a ledger at the center, a corporate of infrastructure that will be updated and will interact, and the intermediaries will be able to interact with, but not the retail customer. But they don't specify, they don't make a decision here about whether it's token-based or account-based. But it does feel, certainly, that this isn't the kind of token-based model that we're seeing in the private sector. Now, this is clearly up for grabs at this point, and I'm sure the industry will engage with this directly. But if it is, if it ends up on the account-based version, it'll seem odd, I think, to the rest of the industry, where in a way that we've been talking about interoperability and the importance of interoperability between private sector digital money and this public sector form of digital money. It will seem odd, I think, if the public sector version of this digital money works in a very different way at the core infrastructure than the private sector innovation. We also talked about this being a public sector platform for private innovation. And I think it's really important that they do work in this in a similar way. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult. There could easily be frictions. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So I can imagine a world in which an account-based system at the center versus token-based systems offered by the private sector could run into conflict at the wallet level. So the intermediary has to provide a slightly different interface or has to provide different types of integrations. Equally, I think it might interfere with things like programmability and the way they design the private sector versions of money as well. So I think it would be a shame. I'm sure they can get around it, but I think it would be a shame if the digital pound was an account-based version, especially given all the innovation going on in the private sector is around token-based money. And it would also stand in stark contrast with models that we've seen around the world. For example, in Australia and Brazil, where they're clearly thinking about the central bank digital currency as an extension of what they've seen in the private sector, the stablecoins. And so I think that version generates greater efficiencies, especially in terms of the interoperability between them. So it remains to be seen, and I'm sure the industry will engage on this point. But I think it would be a shame, as I say, if the central bank version of the digital currency was an account-based version when the rest of the industry is developing private sector and developing token-based models and innovating in that way.
Thanks, Varun. And I think what I'd like to finish off on, and one thing that I've really taken away from everything you've said throughout this discussion, is that the future is very much going to consist of an ecosystem of different types of money and different types of payments. And you mentioned we will see a continuation of what we have today in the form of cash, cards, various digital card-based payments, and things like that, as well as bank account models, e-money, etc. But we're also going to see this potential proliferation of both public CBDC and privately issued variants of new forms of digital money as well. What's the consumer, what's the end user perspective going to be? Is it just going to be this dizzying, confusing array of different things that I have to choose at any point in time what I'm going to use and how I'm going to convert from one form to another? Or are all of these issuers going to start considering an integrated customer experience and how this can be simplified so people are just able to spend in the form that they need at the right time? How are they going to make that work?
I think we are definitely going to see a diverse array of different options. And I think in the near term, that is going to lead to some confusion because you will have different types of wallets holding different types of money. And you'll have to decide whether to spend in banknotes or using your debit card or using your digital wallet. In a way, we do that today. I choose how I want to pay for something depending on where I am. And I'll use my mobile device to pay when I go on the tube, but I'll use something else to pay for a service, like a subscription service. And I think the key is on the user interface and how well it's designed. I do fear that in the near term, there will be some confusion and we'll have different types of money locked in different apps on our phones. But as you say, in an ideal world, what it develops into is either one of two things. One, as you walk into the supermarket, you always walk into, it's the right form of payment that suddenly pops up on your phone when you want to pay and it knows what you're doing. And that's smart money. And that's then takes all the decision out of your hands. You can pre-program it just like you pre-program with a ride sharing service, which card you want to spend on, and you can get that kind of functionality built in. The other alternative is that by having this digital pound at the center of the ecosystem and ensuring that there is uniformity between different types of currency, actually people won't notice the difference. And if you went back hundreds of years, you'd have different commercial banks issuing pound notes and they would be seen as interchangeable. They were seen as currency. They were the same thing. And you could end up in a world where it doesn't matter who's issuing, which bank of yours or which fintech is issuing you with a tokenized deposit or a stable coin. Because of the costless interchange with the digital pound, they will be seen as pound notes or digital pound notes, no matter what happens. Either of those two scenarios, I think, is fine. But I do worry that there will be a phase in the middle where certainly some people will be left confused and trying to figure out, scratching around their digital wallet for one or 15 different types of payment method. And that could be a challenge in the near term.
It'll be really interesting to see in any case how it all turns out. And thank you very much for joining us today, Varun.
Thank you.
Great having you.
Thanks for having me on.